drive was an auto transformer type, not isolation.
Let's find out, Glenn. You could have had a 6-to-1 turns ratio as an auto transformer, and with a little bit more wire, you could have made it a real primary and secondary winding. Let's see which way you did it, Glenn. KC2QIQ, K2RIW in the tech net.
Reaching the repeater?
You're a little bit noisy, but you're reaching the repeater. Go right ahead, Glenn.
Well, the easiest way to do it, Dick, is to do it with a, use it as an auto transformer, because the auto transformer is going to have the least problems with coupling. If you're going to use it as an isolation transformer, the layering and the losses are going to be much, much higher, and unless you're very experienced at doing that, I don't advise it. KC2QIQ.
Okay, then in the worst case, if you did it as an auto transformer, which is what Glenn did do, which means now the feed point of the input to that device could become hot. The next step to be double darn sure, belt and suspenders, would be now to put a poor man's balun on top of that. If you're winding it as an auto transformer, and you're doing it with a long piece of wire like 10 feet that Tim used to ground, which means you're not exactly at the end of the step, you're a little bit off one end. And now you got some RF on the input network. By putting the 3 or 4 turns of coax cable going into that balancing device, the 3 or 4 turns of cable held together with a piece of black tape is now an RF choke, and now the rest of your cable is cold, going back to the shack, going to the rig on the deck, whatever you like. So by combining that combination, as I said, it'll be belt and suspenders. See if that all makes some sense to you, Ray. And by the way, you can always go to the QRZ, www.amateurradio.tangovictor. A few days from now, this will all be recorded. You can play back the recording and hear all this jazz over again to get the fine details out of it, Ray. And you're allowed to come back next week and ask us the question again, Ray. KC2MMY, K2RIW in the tech net.
Okay, Roger, I think I understand most of it. And I'll probably look it up. It seems pretty easy to build. I do have an unknown. I'm not sure what the ratio is. Just to get something clear, you had stated that the balun normally serves as two functions, the one function being the impedance matching. Just to be clear, the other function is what? Is it stopping feedback from coming down the line? Is that why these balans that you buy have the beads in them? Are we stopping some kind of spurious emission from traveling back down the transmission line? Is that part two over?
You got it, Ray. Those beads that they've got in the commercially made balun really is an RF choke. So that even if the system tries to put RF energy back onto the shield of your coax cable, those ferrite beads, the really great big ferrite rings that are around the coax cable inside of that white piece of tubing of your Unidella balun, that is a real baluning device, an RF choke. A poor man's balun is multiple turns. So yes, there's two things going on here, baluning and impedance matching. And if you use the least amount of wire in the closest coupling between so-called primary and secondary, which is what Glenn did, auto transformer, you don't have a completely separate winding, therefore you don't have a complete baluning device, even though you've got a complete impedance matching device. And now you can add your own baluning device or RF choke, the poor man's balun, of multiple turns of coax cable held together with tape. And now even though your balun becomes a little bit RF hot, as long as it's insulated, you're not putting your hand on it, and your other hand on ground, as long as you've got this poor man's balun, so there's no RF energy flowing down the outside of the cable, going back to the radio on the deck, or going back to the transmission line to the radio in the basement, now that could be an ideal system. And by the time you put this all together, I think it's going to work like a charm, Ray. KC2MMY, K2LIW, the tech man.
KC2QIQ with one more comment.
Glenn's got another comment. Go ahead, Glenn.
Funny thing about working with ferrite is that when you have odd ratios, in other words, when you have something like a 6-to-1 ratio, 9-to-1 ratio, and you're using a piece of ferrite, out there. If you take apart a lot of mobile antennas that match in-set antennas on cars, basically the same ratio that they use for half-wave antennas on automobile mag mounts and things of that nature. So it's very unlikely that you'll end up with a DSWR with a half wavelength on the end of that balance device, transformer device, that's going to be more than 1.5 to 1. AC2QIQ.
Yeah, my interpretation of what you just told us, Glenn, is that it's quite forgiving. So it does give you some balloting action. And as I said, the poor man's ballon added to it would be belt and suspenders. I think 90% of the time it's not required. Okay, Glenn, Ray, good luck with that project. And let us know in future weeks how well it's going. Next person on the list was KC2 Charlie Mike Quebec. KC2 CMQ, K2RIW in the TechNet. Go right ahead, sir. So, you were fairly sure that that person wanted to sign in earlier, John, and if not, time for the mailbag. KC2WGB, K2RIW, go ahead, John.
Yes, I let him know that he was up next, that he sent me a thank you, and he's still on there, but maybe he's just not listening. Give him another call, and then if not, we'll go to the mailbag.
Okay, KC2, Charlie Mike Quebec. Darwin, you're number one on the runway right now. K2RIW, the deck net. Maybe he got called away, John. So go right ahead with the mailbag.
Yep, just got a note. He's at work and he can't transmit right now, so he's busy. All right, let me let it drop and I'll go on to the first question.
I just want to say thanks to everyone on the TechNet, KC2MNY. Thanks, Dick.
Good question, Ray. Go ahead, John.
Oh, good timing, because we have a question here on a Smith chart. One gentleman's learning how to use the Smith chart, and he has a question about the SWR circle. Now, what he has done, he has derived his point on the chart where he has located his position. Then he took the compass from the number one position in the dead center of the chart to that position located by the numbers he was given, and he drew the circle, the SWR circle. He would like to know, what does that represent as he travels clockwise? Right now he's in, I would say, look at the chart, northeast, roughly in a position southeast. Okay, that's where his little dot is. Now, as he draws that circle around, he'd like to know, when he walks around that circle clockwise, what is that? What does that represent? Back to you, Dick, KC2WGB.
Yeah, I think he's going to like the answer on this one. That's one of the pieces of magic of this new chart. By way of your antenna analyzer, your vector network analyzer, your slotted line, your electric wires, whatever, there's all kinds of measuring devices where if you use it to full capability, you will eventually be able to measure the real means of the unknown. You'll be able to measure the resistive component and the reactive component. And if the reactive component is capacitive, it'll be on the lower portion of the Smith chart. If the reactive component is inductive, it'll be in the upper half of the Smith chart. If your device is pure resistance and very low in resistance, it'll be to the left of center on the Smith chart. If your loading device is purely resistor and it's higher in being than 50 ohms, it'll be to the right of center along that horizontal line. If your device on the test is exactly 50 ohms resistor with no reactance, you'll be a dot right in the center of the Smith chart. So let me take a pure resistive example first to show you what's going on. Let me drop. Let's assume that I've got a 50 ohm transmitter, a 50 ohm transmission line. At the end of it, I hang a 100 ohm resistor. And everything you plot on the Smith chart is supposed to be relative impedance, not real impedance, relative impedance, okay? So 100 ohm load, when related to 50 ohm load, is a 2-to-1 ratio. Therefore, that 100 ohm load plotted on the Smith chart will be to the right of center on the circle that's labeled number 2 on resistor. So if you now put the sharp point of your compass at the center of the Smith chart, and you put the pencil on that number 2 and swung a circle, and by the way, that is a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio, as you swing that circle, as you move clockwise from that example I just gave you, that is the equivalent of lengthening the transmission line. That is the real impedance at the end of the transmission line. And now, if your transmission line happened to be a quarter wavelength long, and the crazy way a Smith chart works is that a full circle is a half wavelength. A half circle is a quarter wavelength. So as you walk along that circle from the 3 o'clock position in my example, where the number 2 was, and you now start going to the 4 o'clock, 5 o'clock, 6 o'clock position, and eventually go around to the 9 o'clock position, the 2-to-1 on the right becomes a 0.5 to the left. It's still a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio, but the 0.5 is telling you that now, after a quarter wavelength of transmission line, you will see at the transmitter 25 ohms, still a 2-to-1 ratio. So everything along that circle, is telling you what happens as you lengthen the transmission line. Clockwise moving on the circle is longer transmission line. So in his particular dot, which is in the southeast corner, which really...
Repeater, timeout.
He's starting off in the southeast corner. That really means he's lower than 50 ohms because he's to the left of center. And because he's a negative down to the southeast, that means he's capacitive. So he's got a slight capacitive reactance and a lower resistive component. And as he moves along that circle in a clockwise manner, he's doing the equivalent of stretching his transmission line. As the transmission line from that point back to the transmitter becomes longer and longer, you now move clockwise on that line. Eventually that line hits the pure resistive circle, the pure resistive horizontal line. And so all possible impedances on a low loss transmission line are represented along that circle. Each time you swing on that circle 360 degrees on the circle, it's a half wavelength on the transmission line, real length. Of course, that sounds backwards. Let me explain why that happens. Let me drop. In the real world, your transmitter is issuing a signal. That signal goes down your transmission line and it hits the load. That's the first path. And the transmission line has a certain length to it. Because your load is less than a perfect 50 ohm resistor, some amount of power reflects back. That's the standing wave ratio, causative agent. That reflected signal goes back to your transmission line a second time. Because you traverse the transmission line twice, once going forward and once with the reflecting signal coming back, that's the main reason why a full circle on the Smith chart, on your compass drawn circle with your pencil, represents a half wavelength length of cable, even though the real signal traveled a full wavelength, 360 degrees, because it went down and came back. And that's what you see as the standing wave ratio at the transmitter. So those degrees of rotation, which really are degrees of length of transmission line, is on the perimeter of the chart. But as you can see, there's going to be a magical length of transmission line, which he can eventually read off that Smith chart, telling him how that dot to the southeast corner eventually becomes a pure resistor, and it might be a 0.5, so to speak, which represents a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio, but 0.5 tells him he's going to see a 25-ohm resistor instead of the desirable 50 ohms. Let's see if that helps, John. KC2WGV, K2RIW in the TechNet. Smith charts are fun, but they're not easy at first.
Very good, Dick. Yes, and they are a lot of fun, and it gives you an insight to what's going on. And if you can just make the connections to the things that you're saying and try to picture that in your mind as you're drawing those circles and those fantastic outer perimeter devices that they have on there, those marks, and the things that you can tout with reflection coefficient, a lot of fun. So I wish him luck with that, and I hope he continues. Any more questions on the Smith chart, just send them over, and I'll bring them up on the net. Let me let it drop. I'll go into the next question.
Yeah, the one thing that's wrong with the Smith chart at first, it's got such darn many scales. It's trying to give you so much information at first. It's a little bit confusing. I wish somebody would write a book called Smith Chart for Dummies, in which he gives you a more simplified Smith Chart. The lines and circles on the Smith Chart would still be the same, but the number of other things around the perimeter and all those graphs at the bottom, those horizontal nomographs at the bottom, 80% of those you don't need most of the time. And it's a little bit confusing because you might pick up the wrong one at the wrong time. So if you make believe that everything around the perimeter is not there at first, and all of those nomographs at the bottom are not there at first, it'll help a little bit. KC2, WGB, K2RIW, the TechNet.
KC2 WGB, already. Dick, by the way, good news, on the internet, on YouTube, they do have people that represent the Smith chart with the minimum amount. They'll explain the resistive component line. They show you that. Then they show you the circles that compose those numbers, how they travel, and also the reactance values and how those circles are added. And that's it. All the perimeter stuff is gone and the nomograph at the bottom is gone. So they do have that available on YouTube. And hunt a little bit for it. There's at least 20 different guys on there talking about Smith chart. Good stuff. Let me let it drop.
When you found those YouTube videos, what was your search word on that? And I presume you went to YouTube first, and then you just wrote down the word Smith chart, and it started giving you these options. Is that what you did, John?
Yeah, Dick, I was on Google, and I put in YouTube Smith charts, or no, Smith chart tube. And at least 10 different people with lectures on Smith charts came up. And if you, you know, continue to go down, you'll find even more. And some of them are very good.
Good information. Go right ahead with the next one, John.
Okay. I don't know. Maybe you'll have trouble with this one, trying to explain it. I know you know it. But the gentleman is asking, what is the Nyquist freak? What does it represent, and how do they use it? What do they glean from it? Maybe you could give us a solution on that, Dick. KC2WGB, back to you.
I'm fairly sure we could Google that word and get a lot of information. Before I launch into making a fool of myself, tell me what you believe you know about Nyquist, John, and I'll try to fill in the spaces. Over to you, John, KQRIW.
I know it's a measurement they take concerning frequency and its domain, but I was hoping maybe Eric is around because I know he uses that in the instrument that he uses for measurements. I don't want to mislead anybody.
Okay, I'll tell Eric he can break in at any time. Let's assume that I'm putting a square wave into a transmission line or into some kind of a filter network or into an amplifier. And theory, a square wave has an extremely steep rise time, a flat top, extremely steep fall time, and that's the first cycle, so to speak, and you just keep repeating that. Well, it turns out that to represent that square wave, all of its individual frequency components, if it's a thoroughly symmetric square wave, that means it goes as far positive as it does negative equally, and if you set it up so that one of the transitions is right on the zero time chart. This is an XY plot we're making, and we're drawing the Smith chart, and we're drawing this square wave. In order to thoroughly represent that, it's a so-called Fourier series where all of the odd frequency components will be there. If my square wave was at 1 kilohertz rate, then if I looked at that on a good audio spectrum analyzer, I would see a major component at 1 kilohertz. I'd see a slightly smaller component at 3 kilohertz, 5 kilohertz. All of the odd components would be there if the Smith chart, if the square wave was thoroughly symmetric in the way that I described it. And if I started making the square wave a little bit non-symmetric, make the positive half a little bit longer than the negative half, I would start filling in the even components. That's just the way Fourier series works. Now, in order to get the majority of that energy to flow through my network, it might be my filter, you can set a frequency at which
the majority of the energy is there, and I think that's one of the definitions of Nyquist frequency. Here I'm not sure. I could be dead wrong on this one.
Repeater, time out.
KC2WGB. Interesting stuff. I wonder if Glenn is around. I'm sure he has seen the term and probably might be more familiar, but I agree with your description, but what it's used for, I'm not sure, or what it reveals, but let's put a call out to Glenn, see if he could add anything to it, and we'll go on. Yes, you are, Glenn.
Are you a little bit noisy, but you're making it, Glenn, and I'm looking it up on Google right now. I know I've used it a lot, but I'm having trouble remembering it. You got it, Glenn.
Brian Houston, generally, Dick, is the Nyquist analysis for this week. Closing circuit. If I have a closing loop, I'm going to get a fire circuit. And what I'm looking to find out is gain versus frequency, and find out where, like, zero crossing points are, to find out the amplifier is stable. That's using sometimes called Nyquist analysis. Your description of Nyquist can also describe the cutoff frequency for a nation. So if you have 100 kilohertz pulse, basically one-fifth of that frequency is going to be the amount of modulation that you can fit within that point. Nyquist covers an awful lot of ground, but it's basically form of stability analysis. Not sure where you want to go with it, but we could spend a whole night on this one, Dick. KC2QIQ.
Yeah, good information, Glenn, and some of it's starting to come back. Turns out that whenever you have any kind of a two-port device, filter, amplifier, transformer, whatever, and you put in various frequencies as the input signal, and you look at what comes out, you can plot the gain versus frequency, or the loss versus frequency, that's the amplitude plot, but also plot the phase shift through the network, phase shift versus frequency. Both of those are very important. If that amplifying device or that passive filter device is part of a servo mechanism, like say for instance you're creating the feedback loop of an operational amplifier, or you really have a servo mechanism. In other words, let me drop. The most ideal servo mechanism I can think of as a ham radio operator is you've got a box in the shack which has got a dial on it and a knob, and as you turn the knob, the dial will move, indicating that your antenna rotator has followed your command. In theory, you could make an antenna rotator which is fast enough in response where as you rotate the knob from north toward northeast, the rate at which you rotate the knob dictates the rate at which your antenna on top of the tower is rotating from north to northeast. That would be an ideal servo mechanism that you and I as ham radio operators could build that, okay? And by way of the amplifier that's driving the motor on top of the tower, by way of the position sensing circuit on top of the tower, and the feedback that comes back down to your commanding device, on that box that's on the table in the shack, by way of the amplitude response and the phase response of that total network, there's a whole method of analyzing stability of that servo mechanism. You can do it with Bode plots, and you can do it with the Nyquist analysis technique. The Nyquist analysis technique, if I remember correctly, is more thorough, more complicated, but gives you a better answer. You can get an answer. Let me drop it.
2QIQ with an addition to that, Dick.
I'll go over to you in a second, Glenn. You can get an answer that's good enough. It's a slight approximation when you do the Bode plot. By the Bode plotting technique, you plot amplitude versus frequency response of your closed loop network. By opening up the loop, you put in various signals, you plot amplitude versus time, and you get a Bode plot, and from the Bode plot, you can make an extremely good approximation as to what the phase is doing, and therefore you can determine what's the maximum frequency of response of your servo mechanism. You can decide whether or not it's going to be an oscillator, what is its tamping factor, how fast it will, how much overshoot it's going to give you, and so on when you give it a command. The Nyquist criteria, if I remember correctly, is a much more thorough mathematical analysis of that servo mechanism and its stability criteria. KC2QIQ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Dick, would that also include settling when you come back?
Yes, overshoot, settling time, stability, ringing time, whether or not it breaks into oscillation, all of these are the factors that you're trying to analyze. KC2QIQ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
If you pretty much described most of it, what's happening there, floating analysis is an open loop analysis. So what you can do is you can analyze a closed loop with a Bode analysis by adding up the sum of your Bodes. So in other words, if you have a filter, you can take a Bode plot of the filter, and if you know the feedback amplifier, you can add the feedback amplifier. So by summing all the Bode plots, you can determine the total system's gain, phase, and frequency components, and basically do the analysis. For Nyquist, you don't have to have a sum of components. It can all be done in one, because we do a polar representation where Bode is the rectangular representation, and Nyquist is the polar representation, where you can do the full closed loop analysis in one basic graph, where you can show where stability is with respect to 0 on the graph, minus 1, which is instability, plus 1, which is your resistive component, and your reactive components, the stability of your closed loop network. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Very good, very good, Glenn. And some more of it is starting to come back. When you do the total Nyquist analysis, you eventually, when you boil it down to a so-called canonical equation, you end up with a fraction. You end up with a bunch of terms on the top of the as a numerator, and you end up with a bunch of terms in the denominator of this fraction-like equation. Every one of the places where the denominator goes to zero, which really means you're dividing by zero, they call those poles. And you put those poles as a certain kind of a marking on your polar plot. Every one of the frequencies where the numerator goes to zero, you call those zeros. So you put zero markings on your polar plot, you put polar markings on your polar plot, and by the location of those polar plots, those poles and zeros on the plot, a person who has the right analysis experience will recognize a system that is very stable, a system that's not so stable, and so it is the servo mechanism equivalent of a Smith chart, so to speak. By those poles and zeros put on that chart, an experienced person really knows in a quantitative manner how stable is his network, how long will the ringing time be, how much overshoot he's going to get, and what modifications he's got to make in order to make it more stable and more desirable. Let's see if that's closer to what's going on here, Glenn. KC2QIQ, K2RIW, the TechNet.
And that's basically it, Dick, from my understanding. My understanding of using Nyquist has always been building analysis, so that's where I've dealt with it the most. I know that there are other applications to Nyquist, but that's generally my area of expertise. Back to you, Dick. H-R-I-W-K-2-Q-I-Q.
It always looked at in the frequency domain?
I think the answer is yes. But Glenn, the one thing that was the original question, we now know something about Nyquist method of analyzing a servo mechanism, for instance. But what's the definition of the word Nyquist frequency? KC2QIQ, K2RIW.
Well, I might not have the correct definition, but I can tell you what my understanding is that when I do a closed-loop analysis, basically either a Bode or a Nyquist is always going to have a frequency component, it'll have a phase component, and a gain component. So you have amplitude gain, phase, and frequency. Frequency is one of the three major components of a Nyquist analysis. So when you talk about the Nyquist frequency, sometimes it's also, it has another definition, let me let it drop. This is more of a slang term than an actual definition, but a lot of times when I've heard people in the industry refer to a Nyquist limit or the Nyquist frequency, it's usually what they call the cutoff point. So let's say if you had something that had a modulation frequency of 100 kilohertz, scientifically understood that in Nyquist limits that you can only get modulated information within 20% of the carrier frequency or the fundamental frequency. So let's say if you have a switching power supply of 100 kilohertz, you can only respond as quickly as 20 kilohertz in recovery time and response. Back to you, Dick. H-O-R-I-W-K-C-2-B-I-Q.
And we're slowly starting to see the application of this. My simple example was a servo mechanism that was an antenna rotator system that acts very rapidly compared to your command. Another example would be a phase lock loop system. It turns out that a phase lock loop really is a kind of a servo mechanism. Your command usually is coming from your desire. You switch the dials on your frequency synthesized signal generator, and you set it up to be 101 megahertz. And that really is setting the fractional divide circuit, which in turn is taking the output frequency of your voltage-controlled oscillator, comparing it after the fractional divide to a phase lock comparator that gets compared to the reference oscillator. You decide that it's above or below the right frequency, and you put a positive or negative voltage into the voltage-controlled oscillator, hopefully bringing it onto the right frequency and eventually onto the right phase. So when it comes to servo mechanisms, a phase lock loop system is a beautiful example. A servo mechanism that moves a mechanical object is a very good example. And there's a third example I was going to give, but I can't remember right now. When you plot what's now called the spectral purity, is one of the definitions of the quality of an oscillator. If I'm looking at a crystal-controlled oscillator or a phase-lock loop oscillator, let me drop the phone. And if I put that into an extremely sophisticated thing that looks like a spectrum analyzer, where you now look at the noise sidebands of your phase-lock loop oscillator or your crystal-controlled oscillator, you're looking at various offset frequencies. Your oscillator might be commanded to go to exactly 100 megacycles, and if this is the best of all possible worlds, on an ideal spectrum analyzer, you'd see a pure vertical line at 100 megacycles on the XY plot, frequency horizontal, amplitude vertical. You'd have a pure vertical line at 100 megacycles and nothing else. In the real world, you have a kind of a mountain where the peak of the mountain will be at 100 megacycles, and you look at 1 kc higher, 2 kc higher, and so on, you're going to see a certain amount of energy in the sideband that represents the undesired residual phase modulation and frequency modulation of that oscillator. Every oscillator has got sidebands. An extremely high-quality oscillator, when you go 1 kilohertz away, those sidebands might be 130 decibels suppressed when viewed with a 1 hertz filter. But as I said, the quality of oscillators is something that you can plot in that manner. And when you look at a real output of a phase lock loop oscillator, you often see the noise sidebands have a peculiar shape to them. You would expect it to have a pure fall off like a simple mountain. In reality, you're going to quite often see a minor peak to the right and to the left, usually equal in amplitude, where the noise comes down for a while, goes back up a little bit, and then back down again. That place where it peaks as a sideband on the oscillator noise versus frequency plot on a real good phase noise analyzer, that place where it peaks is quite often called the Nyquist frequency of that phase lock loop system. I wonder if you've seen that kind of a plot, and I wonder if you've ever heard it given that definition, Glenn. In some cases, that really means that what is the maximum rate of feedback of the total closed loop of the phase lock system, where it is able to remove the noise of the voltage-controlled oscillator. Outside of that frequency, it has very little action. Inside of that Nyquist frequency of the phase lock loop, your phase lock loop system is doing a lot of work to cancel sideband noise of that oscillator. KC2QIQ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, very much so, Dick. You're dragging me into an area that I was trying to avoid, but when you're looking at Nyquist is always the sum of squares, and that's why it's always referred to many times as square waves, because when you're looking at sums of squares and how squares relate to each other, that look at Nyquist limit, which what happens at 90 degrees, which is 90 degrees is a very, very key number, because 90 degrees with respect to the square wave happens to be minus 3 dB of that. So in other words, so if you have a frequency, let's say that's, let's say so many megahertz, X megahertz, that if you are, that wherever you shift 90 degrees from that center frequency, you have 3 dB of attenuation. Very good thing to know, Nick. H-O-R-I-W-K-H-2-2-2-2.
Yeah, as a way of analyzing noise, where the 90 degree phase shift point represents a 3 dB fall off. I'm trying to remember that one right now. So, we haven't done a good job of answering this one, John, in my own opinion. As you Google the word Nyquist, you'll get a lot more information. It's a highly mathematical analysis, complex frequency domain, frequency phase domain. In other words, you're looking at phase shift versus frequency, amplitude versus frequency, of the open loop or closed loop of a servo mechanism. Nyquist is one of the ways of analyzing stability, ring time, overshoot magnitude, all of those characteristics. So when you put an impulse response into a servo mechanism, something that's trying to follow your command, there's all kinds of ways of getting the best compromise. You can never get a perfect where the system instantaneously responds to your command with absolutely no overshoot and no returning ring and a response time that goes to zero. These are the desirable characteristics, and there's a lot of trade-off required to make the system do what you want and still be stable and not become an oscillator. You got to be very careful. Let me drop this. When you design certain kinds of microwave amplifiers, you got to be very careful about something that's called unconditional stability. In the ideal world, your microwave amplifier, no matter what impedance you put as the input signal and what impedance you put for the load on an amplifier, you'd like the amplifier to act as an amplifier and not break into oscillation. If you can achieve that, it's called unconditional stability. And by doing a Nyquist analysis of your amplifier and all of its circuits and all of its feedback networks, you can come to the conclusion as to whether or not you do have or how close you've come to unconditional stability. And so lots of compromises required. Not everybody has very much understanding on this one. And I'm one of them. KC2WGB, K2RIW. Go ahead, John.
KC2WGB. Great answers, guys. Really, that's a lot of information. And I can tell, Dick, as you're speaking, you're recalling different things about Nyquist and its applications. Very good. That was a lot of information. I was worried about that one. I thought that was going to be a stumper for a while. But very good. Let's head to the mailbag. Let's go over to Paul and see what he's got. Back to you, Dick, KC2WGB.
Every so often, I get a letter, Paul, where somebody says, my favorite part of the TechNet is the space report. I really like knowing what NASA is doing. And I'm trying to remember now. What was I looking at this week? I looked at something this week in which I found out something NASA has done or is doing that I didn't know about, and I was going to bring it to our attention. As you talk, I'll hopefully think of it. WS2N, our space expert. And how's Voyager doing, as if I didn't know? K2RI. Oh, by the way, there's been lots of questions this week on the microwave reflector about traveling wave tubes and how long they last. And what happens to the emission? What happens to overload? What happens if you overdrive and underdrive? What happens if there's a filter in the output? What happens if you buy a 300-watt ground station traveling wave tube amplifier that's supposed to put out 300 watts between 14 and 16 gigahertz, and you now start using it at 10 gigahertz instead? What happens? Tremendous number of questions along those lines. And I was thinking about that beautiful traveling wave tube on Voyager. When you go to the Teledyne MEC website, let me drop them. And this is a website where they give you a beautiful tutorial. Traveling wave tubes for dummies, what it should be called. They give you a beautiful tutorial about how the tube works and what happens at end of life. And you read that article and you look about the number of hours of life you can get out of the cathode of a traveling wave tube. You start thinking about the number of hours, 8,700 hours, something like that, per year. You've got, rarely do you get a tube that goes beyond 3,000 hours of life of a traveling wave tube. And here we have something like 35 or 37 years of life of that traveling wave tube that's on Voyager. According to the articles you can read, that thing should have gone out of life over, should have become too old to operate a long time ago. I'm getting the impression that what NASA probably does is they don't run that tube continuously. How much as they let it rest between the times that they're giving commands to Voyager.
There's also two of them, aren't there, Dick?
Yeah, I think they're on the second tube, though. I think the first one they've already had to bypass and go over to the standby tube, so to speak. So I'm guessing that tube is only turned on intermittently, Paul, because they've got much too many hours of use out of the tube if it was being used continuously. WS2N, KQRIW in the TechNet.
WS2N, I know it's an average of once a week they will send a command up, and of course command coming back. So in that time frame that they do it in, I don't know how long it is, but even if it was a half hour, I doubt it's that long per week. And yeah, Pioneers, they have the same traveling wave tubes, and they lasted for a long time. The spacecraft stopped working, but not because of the traveling wave tube. And we'll see what happens with New Horizon as well in the future. But I just want to mention, we'll get back to Voyager. By the way, we're up to 131 AU on one and 108 AU on Voyager 2. Big flight coming up, as far as I'm concerned, is it wasn't going to be this Friday, but now it's going to be Sunday, actually on field day, and that'll take place in the morning around 10:20 a.m. We have SpaceX that's going to launch another Dragon cargo vessel up to the space station. The seventh one that they get paid for, they did. It's the eighth one that they're actually going to dock with the space station. The reason for that is the first one was on them. It was a test. So this is the seventh actual paid mission to the space station. It's going to launch from Florida, Cape Canaveral. And it's going to bring the first of two NASA docking adapters. New docking adapters to the International Space Station will be installed onto PMA-2. PMA is a pressure mating adapter 2. That's a conical offset contraption that's attached to the space station that the shuttle used to dock to. Now that the shuttle is retired, they don't need the docking APS-95 anymore. And that's all been redesigned, and they now call it the NASA docking system. And, so it's first of two, and that'll be attached, and they need their spacewalk to do it. Once they bring it up, it'll come out of the trunk, the back of the unpressurized area of the Dragon spacecraft. So it should be interesting to see that bolted up, because in the future, that's what's going to be able to, we're going to be able to bring people up, dock with the space station, either with the crewed version of the Dragon spacecraft or with Boeing's CST-100 that's also in development, or any other country or company that develops a docking spacecraft in the future will dock to these ports. Right now, you have the Russians that use their own docking system for Soyuz and for the Progress. They have four docking ports in the back of the space station. We have the front of the space station, they have the back of the space station. So I'll be looking forward to that flight, because that will be the one that, they're going to attempt to to save and then eventually reuse the first booster of the Falcon 9 rocket. Nine Merlin engines are in there, and they'd like to be able to save that and reuse it. The cost of space flight was significant.
typically go down. I know I've said this many times in the past. They've tried it quite a few times, and they're going to bring it back and try to land it again on the autonomous barge that'll be out in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean. So they got close to that last two times. And then another time they were going to do it, the seas were too high, and they just can't fly it all together, and they just sent it up to the space station. But they've got two very close landings that they tried on this barge, and if they can nail it, probably the next flight would be, they'd get an approval to try to do the same thing and land on land in Florida. They have a launch facility in Cape Canaveral that they would like to use for that purpose. They've got one built, or almost built, in Vandenberg, so there'll be a, they don't have an autonomous barge floating around in the Pacific Ocean, but one of the flights, probably the Jason spacecraft that they plan on launching later this year, will be one of the attempts to bring that same first booster back to the Vandenberg Air Force Base. That they have they'd like to bring it right back to the land. They'd have a better shot instead of having, you know, use this floating barge. But we'll see. Sooner or later, they've got to do something. A few other things I want to bring up. I know I talked about it briefly last week, the Europa Clipper, and now, you know, it's a planned mission to Europa, one of the moons around Jupiter, and as last week, they were talking about it, looked pretty good, but now they've approved it, and they can actually start going into building hardware and really getting into doing it. Now it's going to get funded for it, and what that mission is they're going to send a spacecraft to Jupiter, and we have one going there now, but this one's going to orbit the planet as well, in such a way that it passes Europa very closely, at least 44 times during its primary mission. This is WS2N. Well, what they plan on doing is launching this in 2020, and hopefully we'll get there about 5 years later. And if anything is successful, it's the Galileo mission that had gone to Jupiter for years. They should be, you know, thrilled to get the data back, because there's theories that Europa could hold some kind of biological life. You know, that's always the main goal for NASA and all the politicians and all the scientists. But to find out if there's any kind of life in the universe besides right here on Earth. So that was interesting that we talked about it recently, and sure enough, it was approved. And another development, talking about reusable spacecraft, similar to the idea that SpaceX has. They'd like to save all the boosters and eventually the second booster. They really want to save everything. Someday down the line, they even want to save the bearings that come off of the top of the spacecraft. They like to have them float down on parachutes. I mean, this guy's really good for the ecology. Elon Musk, the head of SpaceX. There's another outfit run by the European Space Agency that launches rockets out of South America, called the Ariane 5, eventually the Ariane 6. The Ariane 5 launches out of French Guiana, and they put, you know, probably 80 or 90 spacecraft into orbit over the years. And there's a company, Airbus, that builds these rockets, would like to make the booster, which is a, you know, it's a heavy-duty booster, liquid hydrogen, liquid oxygen. They'd like to make that reusable. For the last 5 years, since 2011, they've been designing little fins at the bottom of the spacecraft. And they'd like to attach these things, little bearings on these fins. And after it goes up, it does its job, separates from the second stage. First stage booster would have these little bearings on these like wing-like devices on the bottom of the engine. Little bearings pop off, and they're going to have propellers. And as this thing, you know, comes back and re-enters the atmosphere, and eventually slows down, these wing-like devices will be coming back like a drone. Eventually, these propellers will spin up.
Repeater, timeout.
I timed out. Eventually, these propellers would spin up, and it would come back like a drone and land on a runway, just the bottom part of the booster. And what the engines are, I think, you know, that's the most expensive part. That's where, you know, the engines are, 80% of the hardware, and then the top part, you know, of the booster would still be expendable. So it's a different system than what Elon Musk wants to do. He'd like to bring the whole contraption back in pieces. But it's something. It's to show that it shows you what competition does. They had no intention, you know, European Space Agency, of doing anything like this in the near future. And here they are trying to develop something. They need funding. My guess, that probably won't happen. They'd be happy if that happened in 2025, if they were able to get to that point to use it on an Ariane 5 or upcoming, hasn't flown yet, Ariane 6 rocket that's under development. And they have a name for it. It's called Adeline, and it's short for Advanced Expendable Launcher with Innovative Engine Economy. So we'll see how Adeline does in the future. Keep my eyes on development, let you know down the road. A lot of spacecraft going up to the International Space Station that I mentioned before, this is the docking system. And one of the ones that's compatible with is got a flight coming up, and I believe in August, and that flies out of the Japanese launch facility. Japan launches an H-2B rocket, and attached to that is the HTV. HTV-2 is the launcher, and the HTV is the docking cargo vessel. They've done this, I think, five other times. I think this will be the sixth. Roughly every year, they will launch one of these flights, and they'll also dock with the space station in the American side. But a little different. It's not important that they don't need the docking ring. They, you know, any cargo flights, including the next cargo space flight, SpaceX flight that goes up, they don't dock to the PMS, the existing system. They convert to the docking system and a berthing system. Any of the cargo vessels that berth, they bolt up 16 bolts.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
They don't really dock. They bolt up to the space station with these 16 bolts. And but it's a little different, but they do attach to the American side. We have a docking system. You got bigger equipment coming into the space station on a berthing setup. Docking is 31 inches in diameter, so you can get through. With the berthing system, this big rectangular door opens up, and the width of the door is 50 inches, 5-0, so big difference. You can bring in big racks and big scientific equipment, and makes it a lot better. So that's roughly it, Dick. We're looking for New Horizons to enter Pluto's Pluto's vicinity on the 14th of July. And I'm going to keep my eyes on that. I have an app for the tablet called Pluto Safari. It's free, and it's excellent. And one of the cool things, every time you bring it up, it's got a countdown, how many days, how many hours, how many minutes before it gets to within 7,000 miles of the Pluto surface. Send back that data, which they'll be getting back for a month after they leave. Take pictures of the planet, I'm going to call it the planet, and the moon surrounding it. Dick, any questions or anything? I'll turn it back to you. And I can be reached at my call letters at ARRL.net.
Reach you there with a question.
SpaceNetReport at gmail.com. I hear John in there too. Dick, over to you.
Fire away with your question, John. KC2WGB, K2RIW.
KC2WGB. Paul, if you know the door locks, those threaded bolts or whatever that you're talking about on the cargo door, are they mechanically driven, manually driven, hydraulic? How do they thread up, if you know? Back to you.
They're electrically driven, and the torque on those things is, I checked a lot of different websites, and because I couldn't believe it, it's 16,000 pound torque. I mean, these things really sock up, so that you don't have a guy at the end there with a torque wrench, and of course, it's slower. They have to manually, and there is manual work involved, they manually attach the power cables, for instance, like when the Cygnus spacecraft goes up, or Dragon spacecraft goes up, they have to manually attach power cables, you need lights, there's air conditioning in this thing, it becomes a room for the month or two that it's docked with the, or birds, I like to use the right word, birds with the space station. And disconnect it, it takes time. It takes, an hour or two to undo this. So it's not good for people, but it's great for cargo. As I mentioned before, you can bring in bigger stuff. But not good for people. Let me drop it. If they need to abandon ship, if there's a fire or something, get hit by a meteor, and they need to get out in a hurry. There might be an ammonia leak. They could jump into the any spacecraft and be away, in a matter of 15 minutes, whatever it takes to get into that spacecraft. And that's an automatic system. These docking setups that they have. Disconnect from the space station. When the spacecraft docks with the spacecraft, one of the things that happens is there's springs that on the system that when they pull themselves together, the springs actually force themselves apart when they undock. So along with it, they disconnect automatically the power system that gets piped into the spacecraft, a manned spacecraft. They did that a lot with the space shuttle. They pick up the power from the solar panels. So